is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the contributions American women made during World War II. Journalist Emily Ellen is our guest. She is the author of Our Mother's War, American Women at Home and at the Front During World War II. Emily Ellen's mother spent time as a Red Cross worker in the Pacific during the war. She joined the Red Cross in the last year of the war. The book, Our Mother's War, provides a portrait of American women like Emily's mother, Carol Lynn Yellen. Women were being asked, were being expected to do things they had not been asked to do or allowed to do previously. In the prologue to Our Mother's War, Emily Yellen writes of becoming aware of her mother's story after her mother's death in 1999. It set her on a quest to learn more about her mother's generation. Let me quote from the prologue. Like many women during the war, my mother had planted a victory garden, volunteered at a USO canteen, and coped with rationing. And my mother had played a number of the roles that women all over the country played during that time. War bride, military wife, career woman, Red Cross girl. But what about the millions of women who worked in defense plants to produce the weapons that helped the Allies win the war? And what about the women who joined the military in non-combat positions in the Army as WACs, the Navy as WAVES, as Army pilots called WASPs, or in any of the other branches of the military that opened to women for the first time during World War II? And what about all the lesser-known stories that my writer's instinct was telling me were just waiting to be told? Listeners, you can join the discussion with questions and comments this afternoon. Perhaps you have a story from your experience or your family's experience involving the contributions of women during the war. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL and 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, Emily Ellen, is a longtime contributor to the New York Times. Her work has also appeared in Newsweek and other publications. Her book, Our Mother's War, American Women at Home and at the Front During World War II, is published by the Free Press. And you can find her on the web at OurMothersWar.com. That's OurMothersWar.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Emily Ellen, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, tell us how it was that you began to have a true appreciation for your mother's life as a young woman during the Second World War.
Well, you know, I think that when I was growing up, my father's war stories are the ones that really we talked about around the dinner table. And my mother would always add, you know, oh, when I was in Saipan, my father was in Burma. And she died in 1999, as you said, and about a year later, I was going through some of her things, and I found four shoeboxes marked 1940s, and inside were hundreds of letters that my mother wrote home during the war. And she actually started the war at Northwestern University, where she finished a master's degree in journalism. She had an undergraduate degree there from there in history. And she married her husband, her first husband, right when the war started, as many women did. And he went off to the Navy. And he had been an editor at Reader's Digest the year before. And she literally took his job. She did tell me. I knew a little bit about the facts of her life, but what the letters did for me was open up, you know, the daily experience and really show me what my mother had gone through. And I reconsidered and realized that the women's experience of World War II really was not something that I had thought much about. And I sort of, you know, went from there as a journalist and said, I bet a lot of people, you know, would have the same experience.
Yeah. Did you wonder why your mom hadn't shared those letters with you before her death?
You know, it was probably not anything conscious on either of our parts. I think she might not have thought I was interested. And, you know, frankly, I might not have been as much as I was, unfortunately, after she died. You know, just in the everyday of life, you're living in the now, you know. When someone goes, you're wanting connections with them. And that's what the letters really did. It gave me another chance to have a big, long conversation with my mother.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mother was also, she was an editor and a writer. And so I felt almost like she had left them behind for me on purpose. I mean, you know, it's probably not, again, a conscious thing. But when I found them, I found this woman who I knew, but it was at an earlier time before she was my mother. And she was young. This was her first big adventure because she did work in New York at the Reader's Digest for 3 years, which was a great job and also was very pioneering for women at the time, and then decided, you know, that she wanted to be more active in the war effort and decided to join the Red Cross, which was a way for women to go overseas without being in the military. And she did that and was sent to Saipan. So my mother went to war. You know,
yeah.
And I had never really thought of it that way. I'd always thought of her and all the other women as kind of helpers. And even in the Red Cross role, it was like, well, she was there to serve the men. But when I read her letters, I saw, you know, she had her own experience. And it was really amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm thinking now to the epilogue of the book where you write about your mom and her work in the women's movement,
yeah.
And she gave a speech, and I think this speaks so eloquently to why those letters and photos and diaries, why those things wound up in the attic in shoeboxes, is because she was very much, you know, living her life as, you know, as an activist and
right.
and a mom.
Right.
And you have a little bit of a speech in here that yeah. she gave a talk, and she began her talk on this particular day by apologizing for not being better organized. She said,
and I think you should mention it was in 1971.
Right.
And she gave a talk and she called it The Humanization of Emily, Some Thoughts on My Daughter and Women's Liberation. Of course, I'm Emily. And I was 9 years old. I don't remember the speech at all.
Yeah.
But then I did find it sort of at the end of the book, actually. And I was thinking, well, how am I going to end this? I want to revisit my mother, you know, but what can I ask her? You know, how can I ask her about this whole experience? And I found this speech. And again, I sort of felt like I was being set up, you know, by my mother and my grandmother in a good way.
Yeah. Well, she began that speech. I think perhaps this speech should be retitled Some Thoughts While Defrosting the Freezer and Taking Care of My Daughter Who Had a Cold, and Getting My Boys Off to a Baseball Game and Keeping the House Quiet So My Husband Could Work and Making Minestrone for Dinner on the Hibachi on the Back Terrace Because the Kitchen Was Cluttered with Everything Defrosting from the Freezer.
That's right.
Women's work and never done.
Exactly. And she said that's how she should have renamed the speech, because that's what she was trying to do. Or that's what she was doing when she was hoping to make notes for her speech. And every bit, you know, every current day woman who reads that, I think, you know, and men too, understand, you know, that there she was. She was a mother, she was a wife, she also had a career, and, you know, four children. And I do have to say, my father, you know, was very supportive, and that's the other nice thing about this book, is I'm able to talk to men who are finding out about their mothers as well. One of my brothers said to me, you know, this book is not just for women. She was my mother too. And yes, so when I found that from my mother, I felt again almost a spooky sense of, you know, inevitability in having written this, and I felt validated because she talked about women's history and how women's history is not written down. It's the history that's passed on through families, and, you know, that's when I realized letters are some of the best documentation. As a journalist, I'm always looking for documentation, and they're some of the best documentation of women's experiences. And that is what I went for in the book. I tried to get the first-hand accounts of the time. And then I spoke to women who were still alive, you know, that fit into the different groups that I talked about, and used that as sort of supplementary and you know, to bring it out. But I really didn't want to base the whole book on interviews done 60 years later. I wanted to really go to the source documents as much as I could.
Yeah. What did your mom do in Saipan?
She, as I said, she was in the Red Cross, and they were called Red Cross Girls. And you had to be 25, and you had to have a college degree. And what they did was they set up recreational clubs for the soldiers and sailors, one for officers and one for enlisted men. And they were really in charge of morale. And, you know, that can sound trivial compared to fighting, mm-hmm. but I really saw how seriously she took this and how seriously these other college-educated 25 and older-year-old women took this, you know, and the amazing talent that was put into this. And that was how women's talents were used in one way. There were nurses also, and as I said, women in the military who were there as well. My mother talked about, you know, talking to these men for sometimes 16-hour days where they would do all sorts of things, and they would go around to groups that were working and bring them coffee and donuts. And again, that sounds sort of trivial, but especially in the European theater, the Red Cross women were some of the closest to the front of all the women in World War II. And if you can imagine being in a foxhole in France and an American woman comes up and you can talk to her about home and she gives you coffee and donuts, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of heart in what the women did.
Yeah. There's a letter or there's some kind of documentation in the book where someone says to her, "You must be from heaven."
Right, right. actually, that's an interesting part because it was a letter I found where she talked about she and another woman were driving around and they were being driven in a Jeep to serve different men, groups of men, and this was an African-American unit. And, of course, the Army was segregated at the time. And she and another woman were white and were brought, you know, went into this African-American unit and served them coffee and donuts. And they said they had never, you know, she said in her letter, "I don't think they've ever been served by a white woman before." And she said she was really glad she did that. And what was interesting was my mother then later was, we were in Memphis, that's where I grew up, and she was very active in the civil rights movement. So I saw seeds of a lot of the things that my mother became in these letters.
Yeah. Well, you call the years of the war a kind of inadvertent revolution in America. In a sense, it was laying down the groundwork for the civil rights movement and the women's movement. Would you like to expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, it has been said before. That was not a new thought. And certainly the civil rights movement, you know, when African Americans were able to go to Europe and not face segregation as they did here in America and within the Army, they realized, you know, that there were other possibilities. I think they knew, but it became more real when you've experienced it. And I think the same became true certainly for African American women and for all women in America at the time. I don't think that these women, for the most part, set out to change the world. I think that the necessity, the emergency, the situation at the time called on them, and they were, as we said, you know, they stepped into roles that they had never been asked or allowed to do before. And once you've let that genie out of the bottle, you know, even though we have the idea that everybody went back home, all the women went back home, and we had the 1950s, and women went back to their place, I really saw that, you know, the seeds, as I say, were planted. So I spoke to women who had worked in the factories, for instance, and they might never have worked again, but you meet their daughter and she's a doctor or a lawyer or a journalist. And so I think that once women and men saw the capabilities of women, it was hard then to use the argument that women can't do certain things.
Mm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one, right. A caller in Champaign. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have two comments and also a question. I came from a very small town in New York State, and I'm a nurse, and anyhow, that doesn't matter. But you mentioned how important the morale was, and also my comment, often the ordinary becomes extraordinary, and the insignificant becomes significant. Mm. My question is, would the result of World War II have been different had we not had women? And I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thanks.
I really like that question. Of, You know, I think yes, it could have been. I mean, that's hard to say, but I, you know, there are. If I'm not an authority, I can turn to maybe you know, Franklin Roosevelt or Winston Churchill. Franklin Roosevelt said, you know, without the women who worked in the factories, we might not have won the war. Unfortunately, another way to look at it, some of the German officers said the same thing. They said, you know, America was very smart. They brought women into the war and used their power. And, you know, if we had done that in the same way, we might have won the war. So I think that, you know, I again am a journalist, so I try not to make sweeping historical statements without the documentation, but I think those two quotes probably speak to that.
Hmm. Journalist Emily Ellen is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Our Mother's War, American Women at Home and at the Front During World War II. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name, Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area. The telephone number is 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, one of the very important contributions women made was going to work in factories, mills, and shipyards. How many women went to work in these settings?
Well, it's the 6 million is the number that comes up most often. That's the number of women who joined the workforce after World War II. There were already 11 million women in the workforce, but for the most part, they did jobs, waitressing, you know, those kinds of mm-hmm. domestic jobs as well. And in the factories, there really weren't that many, you know, there weren't that many women until World War II. And 6 million women joined the workforce. It became the first time in America when married women outnumbered single women in the workforce. So issues like daycare, issues of juggling, you know, family, and this time, you know, it was family often without a man there. So single mothers working, you know, and they didn't have the sort of knowledge we have now of what that entails. So there wasn't a whole lot of support for them in the ways we might expect today. It is the first time daycare became an issue, you know, a big issue, and there were some daycare centers set up by the government. But for the most part, women made do, you know. And then the other thing is, women didn't just go into the factories for the first time. They also did other things. They went into agriculture. There was something called the Women's Land Army, which took city women and brought them to the rural areas to work on farms, because a lot of the men had gone off to the war, and farm labor was very important. And so, again, the country turned to women as sort of, maybe we can use them. And then also clerical work in Washington. Government was not as open to women, even in the clerical jobs, before World War II. And there was a huge influx of women, and I don't have the number in front of me, but it's in the book, you know, during the early part of the war and throughout, and they were called government girls. And they went to Washington often from small towns, and they were often, you know, in their early 20s. And they went all by themselves often. And in Washington, there was a housing shortage. So they lived in some fairly rudimentary, you know, housing situations, crowded housing situations. And they worked in these jobs. And again, they were called government girls. And just recently I was in Washington, D.C. for the opening of the World War II Memorial, mm-hmm. and I met some of these women as I was talking, and it was just really, it's been so much fun to meet the women that I've written about, you know, aside from the women that I spoke to, but they've come up to me and they're grateful, which is very gratifying, because I don't think that we as a nation have properly validated and thanked them for their service, you know, during this war. Women are half of the greatest generation, and if my book helps, then I've done what I set out to do.
Yeah. Well, I think like your brother, I think there are a lot of children from this generation that are really happy to be able to read this book.
Yeah. Well, that's, that's a really important thing, too, for the children and grandchildren to ask the women who are still here, you know, what their experiences were. Another thing that has happened often is when I speak to women from that era, they'll say, oh, I didn't do much. And you'll say, really? And then they'll say, well, you know, I did send my husband off to war or my brother. And then they say, and I did work in the factory for the first time. And I did have to negotiate rationing. And, oh, yes, I was raising two children all by myself, you know, on like that. And I'm thinking, I've never had to do any of that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned your website, ourmotherswar.com, and I understand that you're seeking tributes to women of this generation. So far, what kind of things have come in?
Well, actually, we just...
You just started.
We just put that up last weekend, so it hasn't gotten too far yet. But what I'm hoping is that sons and daughters, grandsons, granddaughters will write tributes to their mothers and grandmothers and aunts. And also the women themselves will be able to write, you know, about their experiences. And I hope that that's, you know, using modern technology, and it's a way that we can all sort of get to know more about this.
Mm. As I mentioned in my introduction, women at this point in our history were being asked, even were being expected to do things they'd not been asked to do or allowed to do previously. Mm-hmm. How did the mindset here change? How did it flip? Did it change overnight? Was it gradual? How did that happen?
Well, you know, it was actually a very concerted effort on the part of the government for the, you know, in the main. Before the war, women in the workplace were considered taking men's jobs. So often people didn't hire women for that very reason, because it was the Depression and men needed the work, and men, you know, a woman was almost, you know, shunned for taking a job from a man, and so a woman working was not as acceptable. And then suddenly, a couple of years later, just as production for the war was stepping up in industry and there was a need for more workers, the males were going off to war. So the industry was faced with a labor shortage, and they said, well, there are women. And that's when, you know, woman power, I think the Secretary of War even used that word, you know, that's a great resource that we need to tap into. And so the government saw the problem. They saw that husbands, the women themselves, you know, didn't want to go against what they had been brought up with. And so the effort was made to change the mindset, and that's where a lot of the posters that I have in the book and that you see about from World War II, where, you know, there's one where a man is standing behind his wife and she's got a riveter's looking outfit on, and she says, my husband's proud to let me do my work, or something like that. I can't remember the exact wording, but you know, it was really a concerted effort, and posters were a big part of it. We didn't have television at the time. Magazines were a big part of it. And that's where the Rosie the Riveter image came from. And the first depiction of Rosie the Riveter was by Norman Rockwell. And it was a rather, I guess I'd say, beefy-looking woman. And one of the problems for women and for men accepting women was that they didn't want women not to be feminine. And so the one that has endured, the image of Rosie the Riveter that has endured, was created for the government, and it's the woman with the arm, you know, in the fist and holding her thing, and it's her arm up, and it says, "We can do it." And if you'll notice, if you look at that, she has on mascara, her eyebrows are plucked, she has on lipstick and fingernail polish. And I just thought about that, and I thought, you know, and probably most male industry workers didn't have to do that. Worry about that while they were doing this heavy lifting.
No. You note that up until World War II, nursing was the only job women were allowed to do in the Army and Navy. How did that change?
Well, yeah, it was. And it was considered more acceptable for women. And those women, of course, were very courageous and faced awful things, Pearl Harbor and beyond. The way I see it is part of what changed it was in 1920 women were given the right to vote, And so World War II became the first war, the first big war, where women had a voice in the government, and both, you know, in voting, and then there were women in Congress. There had been one or two before, but there were women in Congress, and a woman named Edith Norse Rogers pushed through a bill to allow women into the Army. And when that happened, then the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard, and the Air Force, which was part of the Army at the time, all opened to women. And the only condition, there were a couple of conditions, but one of the biggest that I saw was African-American women were only allowed in the Army. They weren't allowed in the Navy or any of the other branches until the end of the war. So it was a change, again, born of necessity. The idea was these women would free a man to fight. That was the slogan. The thing that was interesting was there was some resentment on the part of the men, because for various reasons, but one of them was some of the men didn't want to be freed to fight. You know, they had a nice desk job, and they didn't have to get in front of the guns. That was part of it. But I think, you know, it really was a case. The women who joined the military during World War II, I like to point this out, they volunteered. They all volunteered. And they volunteered often in the face of opposition from their own family. Brothers would write home and say, you know, and husbands would write home and say, any woman who joins the military, you know, is a prostitute, or, you know, those sorts of things. There were letters that I found like that. Mm. And so these women had to really face down a lot of opposition just to break down that barrier and be the first women in the military.
Yeah, and it was also coming from the pulpit.
Yes, yes. There were speeches from some religious leaders against it. And also, you know, the same sort of thing for the women who went to work. I think, you know, this was before sexual harassment or the glass ceiling or any of those things got publicity, and we didn't have Oprah back then to have people, you know, air their feelings and things that had happened to them. But it was clear when I spoke to women, they would tell me these stories, and sometimes they didn't even, 60 years later, realize that it had a name, sexual harassment, or just harassment, you know, just kind of making it harder on the women. The women did know, the women in the military, in the workplace, did know that they had to prove themselves. They yeah. definitely, for the most part, knew that. And they just did it, you know? And so I saw a heroism, and I saw, as the caller said earlier, you know, the insignificant can become significant, especially in times of war. And little acts of courage that I saw all around were what added up, and then it became hard to ignore for me the way that we might not have, that we really haven't recognized the contributions of women.
Hmm. It's not easy being first, but for a number of women, it was very liberating.
Right. Right. It's true, and that's a good point. One of my favorite parts is the women who said, you know, I figured out I could do these things. I never knew I could before. And there are women who, for the first time, you know, they got their own pay, or they were able to, you know, women who wanted to become doctors instead of nurses, and women who, journalists, which is something close to my experience, mm-hmm. you know, who went and covered the war. Those women, when I read what they wrote and spoke to them, they really did see that they were able to do things that maybe even they didn't know they could do. And then the women who worked in the factories, almost to a woman, told me, you know, it gave me a lot of self-esteem, and I was so proud of what I had done and what I was contributing to the war effort.
Mm-hmm. In the book, Our Mother's War, you mention a film that was released in 1943. It was about the nurses who served in the Philippines, So Proudly We Hail.
Mm-hmm.
This while nurses and other women had been taken prisoners of war
right.
in the Pacific. How did a movie like that affect sentiment at home?
Well, I think, you know, the nurses, again, were the one thing that people could wrap their brains around, I think, that was acceptable for women to do. And when those women who were in the Philippines at the beginning of the war and a day after Pearl Harbor, the Philippines, you know, they were taken prisoner in the days after Pearl Harbor. And they were in a prisoner of war camp for 3 years. And, in fact, that movie it really showed some women who escaped. There were some men and women who escaped as the Japanese were invading. And at the time, those women who were POWs had not been released. And so it was really interesting. I found I had to look at what Hollywood did during the war and what women in Hollywood did during the war. And that's one of the chapters. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of times also films were used as propaganda, you know. In fact, there was a Hal Roach Studios was set up and became part of the Army. It was called Camp Roach. I think that was just an unofficial name. But, in fact, Ronald Reagan was a captain in that division of the Army. And so I think that it's very important to understand the kind of mindset, you know, the propaganda, really, that was working at the time to change the mindset.
Yeah. You mentioned women in journalism and that being near and dear to your heart. Mm-hmm. Well, women also found a place in radio.
Right.
Which is kind of near and dear my heart.
Exactly. That's true. Yes. One of my favorite women, and I she's still alive, and I've met her, and we've become friends and talk often. Her name is Jean Hay. At the time, it was Jean Ruth. But on the radio, she was called Beverly, and her show was Reveille with Beverly. And she became one of the first female disc jockeys during World War II. Before then, it was not women's voices were not considered, you know, authoritative enough to be on the radio. And she started in Denver, but ended up in Los Angeles and ended up having this show on Armed Forces Radio, and it was broadcast all over the world. And she got letters from troops, and, you know, she did a lot, again, for morale. And the value of that is sometimes overlooked, but she has letters that the men wrote to her, and they're just amazing. And if you're looking at the heart of the people and the heart of the war, it comes out in the stories of, you know, the men. They talk about hearing her voice, and they hadn't heard an American woman's voice for more than a year, and it reminded them of everything, you know, and it was so heartening. And that's not a small thing during war.
Yeah. Well, when I was a girl, women were rarely seen or heard on radio and television. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, this was in the 60s when mm-hmm. I was a little girl, as announcers, program hosts, or journalists. Were there many women like Beverly, like Jean Ruth?
Not too many. She is the only one that I seeked out and spoke to. I have heard of other women. I didn't research it too much further to find out exactly how many, but I do know there were others. And, you know, the other thing is, in all of these areas, the women who did this, they often didn't ask for a whole lot of recognition. And, you know, that's sometimes, I think that's one of the marks of a hero, you know. They just do it, and they consider it something that anybody in the same position would have done. But we, the next generation, and years later, can look at it in a different light, perhaps.
Hmm. There's a chapter in the book, Chapter 7, Jane Crow, mm-hmm. African-American Women. The chapter obviously devoted to African-American women and their experience. How different was their experience at home and at the front from white women?
Well, I got the title for that chapter from a woman in the book, and she had gone to Howard University. Her name was Polly Murray, and she's an amazing woman. But she said she was at law school at Howard, which is a historically black college, and even in the black community, you know, she was one of the only women in law school at that time at Howard, and one of her professors the first year told her, "I don't know why women would want to go into law. You know, it's not a place for women." And she said, "He didn't know it, but he's the reason that I became first in my class." And I love that. And, you know, she said that black women had to deal with two things. They had to deal with the racism that was so prevalent and, you know, encoded in America at that time with Jim Crow. And it wasn't just in the South. I mean, she was in Washington, D.C., and she led, demonstrations to try and integrate restaurants. And then, you know, also the thing that all women had to put up with, the challenges we've been discussing. And in fact, in the black community, it's almost three things, because in the black community there was something called double victory. And that was the idea that the men and women were fighting fascism and Nazism abroad and were fighting racism at home.
Yeah.
So the women that joined the military were also segregated, just as the men who joined the military were. And there's an amazing, just sad, you know, story about Lena Horne, who was a very popular entertainer at the time. And she was performing at an army base, I believe it was, in Kansas. And she talked about having to perform for the white soldiers at night in the arena, you know, in the theater or whatever, the stage that was set up and well lit. And then she asked, where are the black soldiers? And then they said, oh, you'll do that in the morning. And, you know, not only was that inconvenient for an entertainer, but it was just that she then went to the place where they were supposed to perform. It was a rudimentary stage. And she looked out, and in the first three rows were all white men. And she said, what's that? And somebody told her, and then the black men were behind them, and the black troops. And she was told they were German POWs. So the German POWs were allowed to sit before the white, before the black American soldiers. And she was so angry, she stormed out. And she ended up going to the NAACP office in that town. So she then, from then on, she had money, and she had some power, and so she did her own tours and quit doing tours for the government.
Yeah. Well, we've mentioned Rosie the Riveter and how we celebrate those women who went to work. But at the outset of this chapter, we get a sense that all was not rosy. In late summer of 1943, you write, 22 white women walked off their jobs at a Western Electric plant in Baltimore after one black woman was transferred into their formerly all-white department. The white women vowed they would not return to work until the company provided separate bathroom facilities for black and white workers. So still, you know, at home, you know, on the home front, things very difficult.
Right. Well, you know, it was the legacy of so much of what went before. And, you know, to think about that now, it seems silly. But in the time, you know, there were huge challenges ahead after World War II for African Americans, and I think, too, for women. And so all of this, I tried to look at it in the context of the time. I certainly was, I couldn't help but have a 21st century view, because that's when I wrote it, but I really wanted to understand it in the time. And, you know, those women, not at all, you know, in my opinion, not justified, but in the way they were brought up, those women were afraid, those women were fueled by hate, and there's an irony that, you know, again, we're fighting that same thing abroad with Nazism and fascism, and there it was on the home front. And so I tried not to gloss over that.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, a caller on line one in Bloomington, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm delighted to hear people speaking about women on the home front. I'm a World War II historian, and I have to say there is a misconception that I hope that I can help you clear up, and that is that women were a part of the military before World War II and in non-nursing situations. And I'm sure you're familiar with the Yeomanettes, for example,
yes,
of World War I.
Yes.
And so they really weren't the first. When I attended the National Archives, it was a reunion of all the women from World War II military units who wanted to attend. They were excited to be able to carry the torch forward, though, of course, obviously they were the first in certain situations. They did have a sense that they were really expanding what had happened in World War I.
Yeah. The thing, though, that I really wanted, you know, that I was the bills that went through Congress that actually established the women's services. In the Marines, as you said, did accept women as yeomanettes in World War I. But this was a full scale, you know, the entire military opened to women during World War II. So that was sort of how I made that delineation. But there are always, you know, exceptions.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free 800-222-9455. We've got about 5 minutes remaining in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Emily Yellen, author of Our Mother's War, American Women at Home and at the Front During World War II. One of the things that took me by surprise, I wonder if it took you by surprise, the mother's movement.
Yeah, that's one of the most stunning things that I found. It's a group of women that were isolationists, and there were isolationists before World War II who didn't think we should get into this war. And but when Pearl Harbor happened, a lot of that died down, and the country really did unite against, you know, or for the war. But these women were holdouts, and in fact, at one point, they claimed they were 100,000 strong, and a lot of them were based in Chicago. And they started these groups called the Mothers Movement. And all of the groups, there were different groups around the country in each city, but they didn't have one name. That was actually on purpose. They would have different names so that they couldn't really be traced. But Mothers was always in the name. You know, it was We the Mothers, Search for America or something. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting. United for America, I think it is. And other groups like that. But the irony, again, I found many of these women had no children. So they used the idea of being mothers as a guise to oppose the war. And they said, you know, we don't want our sons dying in this war. And one of the more awful things they did, and there was a lot of hate talk in speeches and things, but one of the things they did was they would get lists of the soldiers who had been killed in a particular town and then write letters to their mothers and say, you know, you should tell Franklin Roosevelt that this war, you know, that it shouldn't have been fought and we don't want to fight for the Jews and that sort of thing. And I even found, you know, Jewish mothers who got that letter after their sons had died. And two of the women were tried for sedition in 1944. And they weren't convicted, but, you know, it really shows that there was a breadth of experience among women, and you know, it's really important to get beyond, it's important to understand the stereotypes we have and then to get beyond them and see the whole picture.
Yeah. We've got a couple of callers here. Let's see if we can get these folks on the air here this afternoon. First, we go to a listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. Well, I just wanted to thank her for writing the book. I'm really anxious to read it. I'm an educator, and I think it's a wonderful piece to be able to bring out to young women today, because I think they need to see that there were struggles before them. They often feel there's so many struggles being single moms and moving forward today, and I think
Right. It'll
be great for them to see that there are correlations with their past and whether they're black or white, and that there's a way that women can be greatly successful. So I'm really looking forward to providing it to students and opening a door for them.
Thank you so much, and please encourage them to visit my website at ourmotherswar.com, because I'm trying to open that discussion. I'd love to hear from younger women as well.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And our last caller this afternoon on line two in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. My question is, were there women who would have landed, shall we say, a D-Day, some of these early type of entries into the war?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of WACs, the Women's Army Corps, came soon after D-Day, and I've actually just heard from someone who said their grandmother was there really close to D-Day, and I'm looking into that, but there were nurses, of course, who landed within days because they were needed, and they tell, you know, awful stories of what they saw. And then in the book also I have women who were in the WACs, the Women's Army Corps, and they talk about, you know, if you read their letters, it could almost be men, except that they say, you know, we're three women to a tent, and we wash our hair in our helmets, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they were really in some fairly rough conditions, and they saw the awful, awful toll of D-Day. And women saw and were, you know, even in some cases a part of, there were women who were killed, nurses, Red Cross workers, who were in the line of fire. And so that's also something that I found. And you know, again, the letters were just stunning.
What type of sources might I look for to follow up on that type of work?
Well, I'll tell you, in my book, I made sure to have a very detailed note so that people could look further into this. I think every chapter in the book, it sometimes is its own book. There are books written already and then, you know, can be its own book. And so that's one thing. And, you know, it's worth just starting in and looking. There's a group called WIMSA, Women in Military Service for America, and they are documenting all military service, but they are real good on World War II as well, and a number of other sources.
Okay. There we have to leave it. We've used up the time.
Yeah, thank you.
Emily Yellen, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Our guest this afternoon, Emily Yellen, is a journalist. She's the author of Our Mother's War, American Women at Home and at the Front During World War II. And you can find her on the web at ourmotherswar.com. And in this case, in this instance, in terms of the website, there's no apostrophe after the S in mothers. So it's ourmotherswar.com. And the book, Our Mother's War, it's published by the Free Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Todd?
Thanks, Celeste. On this last trading day of the week, as tomorrow is an official holiday, a day of mourning for the former president, Ronald Reagan, and markets will be closed on this last trading day of the week. USDA reports released this morning, and the impact was evident across the board. That despite the fact that the numbers really weren't very much different for most of the in supply and demand numbers, and that was just enough of a fundamental change from what the traders were thinking, that they were actually a little bit different, that they pushed the market lower, especially in the corn and the wheat pits. July wheat, in fact, a high today of 356.5, a low at 350, a settlement price there at 350.5, and it finished 9.5 cents lower. September futures, 366 the high. Low at 360, settlement price 361.5, down 9.5 cents. December contract 378, the high, the low at 371.25, settlement price at 372, down 9.5 cents. And the March futures at 383, the high, low at 379.5, a settlement price at 380.25, down 8.75. May futures 385, the high, the low at 381, and a settlement price at 381 on that low, down 9.5 cents. Be sure to stay with us through the next hour as we talk with Dan Zwicker at close to the top of the hour, 6 after the hour, about the commodity markets and what happened with the USDA reports. Dan Zwicker, of course, with AgriVisor Services, joins us here on the Closing Market Report every Thursday afternoon. July corn now, 294 the high, low at 284.5, a settlement price at 285.75, down 11.75 on the day. September, 298.5 high, low at 288.5, a settlement price 289.75, 12.5 cents lower. December futures were down 11.75 cents on the day, a 298 high, a low at 289.5, and a settlement price at 290.75. Once again, that Dease contract settled 11.75 lower. The March futures were down 12 cents. They had a high of 302.5 today, a low at 294.75, and a settlement price at 295. May futures 304.75 high, low at 299, settled 299.5, down 10.75. And July corn 304.5 high, low at 298.5, a settlement 299.25, down 10.25. September contract 285 the high, the low at 283.5. September 2005 corn settled 284, down 5.5, and the December contract for next year 274 the high, the low at 269. December settled 269.5 for 2005, down 3.5 cents on the day. July oats 146.25 high for the day, low at 143. The oats from the Chicago Board of Trade settled 145.25, down 1.5 cents. And the September's a 151.5 high, low at 150, settled at 151. They were a penny and a half lower as well. From the soy complex now, the nearby July contract, 857. The high, the low at 839. Settlement price at 847. They were a nickel lower. August soybean, 797. The high, the low at 780. Settled 784 and a half, down 16 on the day. September beans, 703. The high, the low at 682. Settlement price at 691 and three quarters, down 17 and three quarters. And the November future, 669, the high, the low at 654 and a half, a settlement, 663 and a half, down 15 and a half cents. In January, soybeans for the day, 670, the high, the low at 658, settled 665, down 15 and a half. And the March contract, 669, the high, low at 660, settled 664 and a half, down 15 cents. May futures in the bean pit, 665, the high, the low at 654, settlement price there at 661, they finished a dime lower. July bean meal, 273.50, the high, the low at 268, settled 271.30, down 120, and the August, 259.50, the high, the low at 255.50, settlement price at 258.40, they were 360 lower. July bean oil, 28.17, the high, the low at 27.68, and a settlement price at 27.83, down 38 for the day. The August contract, 27.55, high, low at 26.95, and a settlement price at 27.01, they finished 54 lower. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. August feeder cattle, the high today 108.60, the low 107.10, the settlement 107.50, that down 87 and a half. September 107.25, the high 105.75, the low 105.90, the settlement that down 115. June live cattle 89.25, the high 86.47 and a half, the low 86.75, the settlement that down 272 and a half. July live cattle 91.50, the high 88.50, the low and settlement that down $3, down the limit. Live August cattle 89 even, the high 86.90, the low 87.25, the settlement that down 190. June lean hog 78.50, the high 77.90, the low 78.40, the settlement that up 25. July 76.55, the high 75.35, the low 76.32 and a half, the settlement that up 85. And August lean hog 76.25, the high 74.90, the low, the settlement 76.22 and a half, that up 77 and a half. July bellies, today's high 111.75, the low 107.95, the settlement 111.75, that up 272 and a half. The Dow Jones Industrial Average currently up 24 points at 10,393. The S&P 500 up 3 points at 1135. And the NASDAQ up 8 at 1477.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Joanne Fritz from Columbia, Missouri writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what are divining rods made of?"
Divinity, that pink and white foamy nougat. Moisture from underground water deposits finds its way to the atmosphere above ground and causes the rod to weaken and droop. Of course, some discount dowsers use coat hangers, but they're frauds unless the hangers are made out of divinity. If you've made the mistake of hiring one of those guys, ask to hold the rod. Then take a bite out of the hanger and see. It's worth a few chipped teeth to know the truth.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screen